This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and it is our last Recovering Politicians Tuesday of 2025, so it is time to take stock. Now, I think there's no question that Mark Carney is Canada's top newsmaker of the year. After leading the Liberals out of almost certain defeat by running, first getting elected as the Liberal leader, running on a promise of elbows up against Donald Trump, and that before putting his elbows politely down when it came down to it. So how did he do? And how is he doing? And he just officially named his friend, financier and dealmaker Mark Wiseman, as our next ambassador to Washington, which means we have two Marks running the most important file, that being our relations with the United States and the question for an Alberta referendum on separation has been approved. And let me tell you, it's a lot more straightforward than what voters were confronted with in two Quebec referenda. So today we have text. The elves are still messing with our phone lines. The text line is 866-740-4740, and we can read what you have to say on air.
And now, the Recovering Politicians panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, former health minister and deputy premier with the Liberals here in Ontario, Sherry DeNovo, a former NDP MPP, and Janet Ecker, former Ontario PC MPP and finance minister. Welcome to you all, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Libby, and yeah.
Thanks.
Former colleagues, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, Libby.
Okay. Now, let's begin with the question I'm going to read out. So this is the question that will face Albertans. Do you agree that the province of Alberta should cease to be part of Canada to become an independent state? That's pretty straightforward. So, Janet, what do you think? Are we taking this seriously enough? Janet? Janet, your mic is muted.
No, I'm here.
You're here?
That's right. I'm here. Sorry about that.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. The good news is it's a clear question, a clear yes and no. The bad news is that she's doing it. I mean, I think she's tempting fate. I mean, we saw what happened in the UK with great confidence. They went out the door and asked a question they didn't know the answer to, and they got the answer they didn't want. And the poor Britain is still picking up the pieces. And it would be disastrous for the country. So I'm one of those people who doesn't think she should have put the question on the table, because if she gets, you know, like, what's she going to do with the result? What's going to be a good result? What's good? What's bad? What, you know, I think it was a dumb move, frankly.
Okay. George, what do you think? Are we taking this seriously enough?
I think that the Prime Minister, part of his success is in forward managing this issue. I think that that MOU, which is controversial within some of the quarters that are supporters of the Liberal Party, is in a certain sense part of the salvo in the helping to shape the answer to this question. I think that that is evidence that our national government is taking it seriously. That's the way I would say it.
MOU, people, by the way, is the Memorandum of Understanding, which opens the way to pipelines, maybe. Sherry, what's your take on this?
Well, I'm with Janet on this. I think it was strategically dumb of her in many ways. I also am, you know, I think most Canadians would be very upset. And I suspect most Albertans will be too by the wording. I mean, especially with the flags that are being flown that show, you know, an American flag on there. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, you know, this is kind of just an inch short of treasonous, really. I mean, this is nasty. And especially in a country that's, you know, having to deal with tariffs and, you know, and it's all about elbows up. This is like not only elbows down, this is like no elbows. And, you know, it's embarrassing. I think it's embarrassing internationally. I think it's bad for her strategically. There's nothing good about it. And it, you know, it's just it, ultimately, it's just very sad statement, which will be rejected, hopefully.
I did notice, Janet, that it said to become an independent state, because, you know, I look around. So the results of that referendum, it looks like, cannot be used to make Danielle Smith Governor Smith.
Well, you never know what's going to happen, do you? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, when you look at what's happening out there in the world today, it is a very, very dangerous place and growing increasingly so. And sitting there splitting ourselves apart or splitting our populations apart on divisive issues like this, it's kind of like we've got a death wish. And this country is in many ways in significant trouble. It's security, economy, name a public policy area that poor Prime Minister Carney, you know, can ignore because it's going well. I mean, everything is faulting, and we have a lot of work to do if we're going to come out of the next couple of years as a successful country. And I think dividing ourselves, you know, throwing out red herrings like this, and I get that there's groups in Alberta and Quebec and that have this fantasy about being their own country, but that's not the way to manage it.
Well, yeah, except this is, I would imagine, a salve to her base, George.
I mean, it's interesting, like her base, you know, the lack of support that they demonstrated towards her at her own convention from the stage, etc. That was very telling. I mean, the thing is, I can say that I don't like her. I could say that I wish this wasn't the case and I don't wish that they should be distracting attention with these populist motivated this, that or the other. But they are. And there's a chunk of people out there, probably a bigger chunk there than in most anywhere else in the country, that could be open to these kind of independent aspirations, etc. So I don't want that. I don't want that for my country. And that's why I want to see a government, and I think we have one at the moment nationally, that is going to do its utmost to ensure that the broad majority of the people of Alberta don't see anything but a future within our great country. But I think we have to work to prove that. And I think that our national government's got our best interests at heart there.
Sherry, so how would you rate Mark Carney's first bit in office? It's less than a year.
Well, certainly he's popular. I mean, I think there's a bit of a dip in the polls. I tend to follow the polls. It's part of the reality of being a recovering politician. But I mean, yeah, it's a bit of a dip. But I mean, he's done phenomenally well polls wise. I think he's I kind of with you, Libby, a little bit, like, you know, where's the meat here? Like, what have we actually gained in our negotiations with the United States? I see us, you know, giving Trump kind of what he's asking for in terms of military spending, for example, and on many military items that come from the United States. And yet, what did we get in return? So I think people are going to be increasingly looking at that. I also think that, you know, people are still hurting in our economy. People, you know, looking at their grocery prices going up, looking at spending less this holiday season, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that kind of economy of the household is problematic, and that's going to get more and more problematic unless he spends some money that way and not just, you know, looking at the larger economic issues. Hopefully we get more trade with Europe. Hopefully we get more trade in other places. Hopefully that pans out. But what about now?
Okay, I'm going to read a text from Janice, who thinks that the Prime Minister still has his elbows politely up. Now, excuse me, she's got a reference here I don't quite understand. She says, even though he, quote, stole $4,000 a year from me this year and maybe forever, I'm assuming that's a tax thing. And she does believe that he is smarter than all of us and thinks that his wife may be even smarter. Janice, did he run the country smartly since taking office?
Well, he's certainly got the right to-do list, I would argue. I mean, there are some things you can disagree with. There are some things you wish he'd paid more attention to. But given the time, like, he had a very short time between deciding to do this and ending up being the prime minister. And so he hasn't had a chance to do a lot of the sort of, what do you want to call it, planning, thinking, or whatever. He's sitting there with a government of bureaucrats who are not at operating at peak efficiency. He's unfamiliar with politics. It's a tough road, but I think overall, much as there are some things I could say I disagree with, I think overall he's trying to head us in the right direction. The problem is I don't know what the win is here. This latest security document that the U.S. has released that's supposed to be defining their strategic security interests going forward is talking about making nations like Canada dependent. So having a, like that, we would only be able to buy American weapons, for example, if we're buying things or deal with American companies, sole source, et cetera. You know, it's really going to be tough for him to try and win, get a win with a president and his administration that is continuing to try and dominate Canada, you know, economically or politically or however it's happening. You know, he wants us to be a vassal state. That's very, very clear. And we don't have a lot of options to push back. We have some, and Carney's trying to use them. But, and I'm with Cherry too about how we, you know, we gave up a bunch of things and don't seem to have gotten anything for it, you know, and you kind of wonder what really was happening at the table.
Well, at least, I mean, there but for the grace, at least we're not as badly off as Greenland. Yesterday, Trump appointed a special envoy to Greenland who said his goal is to annex Greenland. So even though Trump has mused about the 51st state, he hasn't talked about taking us over, at least, you know, not in the last 24, 48 hours, George.
You know, Trump is the Canadian newsmaker of the year. He's making Mark Carney possible. He made Mark Carney possible. And he's making Doug Ford untouchable, despite scandal. So I think we have to just, I think Canadians have faced up to that. You always want to play this elbows up, elbows down. It's a more sophisticated game than that. Slogans are wonderful. Canadians know, holy moly, we're into the mix here and it's sophisticated. And so far they're inclined to say, well, I really am glad that the fellow that's doing this is as smart as he is because it's very tough and complicated. And the end results will be what they will be. But like, I don't think enough credit is given to the focus that they've brought around, as an example, getting these major projects going. Now, infrastructure projects with a are long, and as we look at the Eglinton Crosstown LRT, they can take decades. But, you know, the speed with which they're contemplating to do things like that, Alto train and a variety of other things, is very significant evidence of a change. So I think that considering the guy came out of nowhere, he's done really very well, mostly putting one foot forward. But our situation's still complicated because of Trump, and Canadians can see that. They can see right through that. The Greenland thing, what worries me there is that the Denmark has said, hey, like Greenland, you know, kind of acknowledged more the independence of Greenland. There's only like 55,000 people there or something, if I read it well. Imagine that you actually just have to win a vote out of 55,000 people to actually cede your independence or something. Like, I don't know what's possible there, but with such a small national indigenous population on Greenland, it really, really makes me kind of interested to know, like, what are the influences that a massive country like the United States can bring to bear there? It's, to me, it's shocking, but also really quite frightening.
Okay. Well, We have a text from someone who did not want to leave their name, who says he disagreed that Mark Carney is the problem. He does not have the best interests of Alberta at heart, which I suppose is arguable. A lot of the separatists in Alberta, the people from Danielle Smith's base, would probably agree with that listener. In the meantime, so we have a new ambassador to the United States. He is Mark Wiseman. This was not a surprise. He's being touted as a good friend of Mark Carney. And the thought apparently is that because this guy is so successful in business, Donald Trump will respect him. Janet, do you kind of buy that logic?
Oh, who the heck knows with Trump, eh? But I think Wiseman, I mean, what's important for a role like that is that the prime minister feels he's got somebody there he can trust. And secondly, that he's got somebody there who will speak truth to power. I mean, I don't know Mark Wiseman well, but I had worked with him marginally, you know, several years ago, et cetera. Think highly of him. He doesn't have the diplomatic background, which people say may be at fault, but he's smart enough to know that he needs to do some learning on the job. So I think it was probably a reasonably good pick. And yes, he does have credibility as a business person. And that's a good thing. So I think not a bad pick, I would say. Your person who did the email or the text to you, you know, I think they've seen more sensitivity from Ottawa to Alberta than they've seen from Ottawa in a lot of years. I mean, Tim Hodgson, who, again, I know, who's a good guy. I'm saying nice things about liberals, George. Boy, it must be a new year. But Tim has worked really hard. You know, like, he's trying, you know, to do deals, et cetera, and work with Alberta. And I don't think we've seen that kind of reach out from Ottawa for years to Alberta.
So we have another text. I had no idea some of our listeners were so passionate about Alberta. This is Mike in Brantford, who says that Danielle Smith got snowed. And he said there won't be a pipeline. And quote this, I'm quoting Mike, Carney is a dismal failure in every way. And without Trump, Carney would have lost the election. I think that we would certainly agree that Carney won the election because of Trump. A comment on that. Janet, go ahead.
No, probably. Yeah, probably. I think that was the thing that changed things around, because the whole world was walking around thinking that Poilievre had it wrapped up. And the pollsters were telling you that, you know, to the extent that anything's wrapped up, it was. But Trump changed the whole dynamic completely. And yeah, he is why we have Prime Minister Mark Carney.
And here is a text that, you know, if I was saying this in the legislature, I'd get thrown out. So it says, more suitable Carney title is Liar of the Year. I don't know. A little harsh, perhaps?
That's just, it's kind of just nasty. I don't think that's who he is. And I would kind of somewhat disagree. I mean, I think if Justin Trudeau had been still, head of the Liberal Party, despite Trump, Poilievre would have won. So I think that Carney does have something to do with that win. And the change of leadership does have something to do with the fortunes of a political party. And certainly from the NDP perspective, we're hoping, you know. One person does make a difference. There's no question about it. I think Mark Carney made the difference for the Liberal Party. We'll see if it's lasting. That's all.
Okay. I have another text. I'm not really sure what Debbie here is getting at, but... she said, if I had to pick someone to help me, I would definitely be choosing someone that supports me and my party. You don't take a knife to a gunfight. So I'm not sure. Are we taking knives to a gunfight, George?
Well, the thing is that if the other side actually has all the guns and you don't hardly have any, you'd be wise not to get into that kind of a kerfuffle, wouldn't you? And I think this is really what Carney's been all about. There's different ways to be elbows up, and the best elbows you give are the ones that the referee doesn't see. And you have to take that from me because I won the Tonya Harding Award in the Gay Hockey League. So I know what I'm talking about. But I do think that the proof is in the pudding, of course, in all of these things. And also, obviously, there's lots of people that are callers or texters to your show and people that live in Alberta that are intensely skeptical about anything that a federal liberal would do. And for a lot of people, that goes back to the National Energy Program and Pierre Trudeau, et cetera, et cetera. So, but I think that Janet said it well, which is that, hey, like compared to what Trudeau was doing vis-a-vis Alberta, you'd have to agree that for most Albertans, they'd be able to that want to see more resource development, that the Carney government is a darn sight improvement over the Trudeau folks. Like, I think a lot of people would even concede that point, but that doesn't mean they're all going to come across the line and forgive, you know, decades and decades and decades of what they've taken as insults.
Janet, I want to talk about Doug Ford for a minute. And I want to talk about those ads that he spent a vast amount of taxpayer dollars on. I think, what was it, $75 million spent south of the border. And yes, I have an interest because we make our living from ads. And I think governments should be helping us out and reaching Canadians who pay the taxes by advertising on our own outlets. And it's interesting that you know, as mercurial as Donald Trump is, a lot of people now directly attribute the fact that he cut off negotiations to being incensed over that ad. Yet Doug Ford keeps saying that was the most successful ad in history. Where do you see it?
Well, it depends on how you define success. It reached, I mean, you know, with an ad, you want it to reach people. Did it have impact? And I suspect that's what the premier's referring to, was the incredible reach it had. And it did have an impact. And the other thing to remember is that for a couple of days, Trump thought it was a great ad. Trump thought it was a great ad and was joking about it. And then, of course, a couple of days later, turned against us. I suspect something would have caused that to happen anyway with him, because we've seen him, you know, up and down like a yo-yo on Canada and on many, many policy positions. So it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. It was a clever ad. It was a good intent. It was a good ad, I thought. It was a good intent to try and get more Americans to realize what's really at stake here with this. And it is unfortunate that it appears to have been the thing that caused a couple of potential agreements to not get done, if you can believe the so-called leaks and stuff that we're hearing.
Aren't we a bit soft on that latter point there, Libby? Like, it was a great ad, okay? It went right to the heart of the matter, and it touched a raw nerve, et cetera, et cetera. But then it seems to have scuppered sectoral agreements. And I don't think there's actually been that much focus to say, like, hey, was that actually worth it? Because the Prime Minister, in wanting to maintain an excellent relationship with Premier Ford, has not been, was very diplomatic and not kind of pointing a finger at Ford and saying, well, were it not for his desire to go forward with that ad, which I asked him not to do, that maybe there'd be people back at work at Algoma Steel or something. Like, I feel like there's been like a little bit soft on making the point or asking the question, like, was it worth it?
Well, I think it was really a good cop, but bad cop thing. I wouldn't be surprised if Mark Carney didn't know about the ad. I mean, I like the ad. I thought it did play well. And I thought it said to the United States what most Canadians would like to say to their fellow Americans, is this really what you voted for? And I noticed that Trump's down in the polls again. Now, will there be an election? Will it make a difference down there? I think that's our real hope in Canada, is that they vote him out. And so did that help? Maybe.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left. It's Christmas in 2 days and then a new year. So I'm going to go around. What is your major prediction for the new year, George?
my major prediction for the new year is that Donald Trump will continue to be the most significant influence over Canadian politics, and also that some person will emerge to run for the provincial Liberal leadership that excites us.
That excites you, okay, because some person will probably emerge. Janet, your prediction, please.
Yes, and sorry about the noise in the background. I can't do anything about it here at the moment, but I think George is right. Trump is going to continue to be the news story for quite some time, unfortunately. And the second thing is Canada does have to figure out how we stop the anti-Jewish hate that's going on in this country. It's absolutely alarming. And if we don't do some action, something really bad is going to happen this year. I hate to say it, but that's what I believe.
Well, thank you for that. I had a huge amount of hope from the things. Finally, politicians here were at least saying the right things after the Bondi Beach massacre. But we had incidents over the weekend where, and Jason Kenney wrote something on this saying where authorities, police, provincial authorities could have used laws that exist to charge people, to clamp down on it, but of course chose not to. Sherry, I will give you the last word. What do you think the major event will be?
I mean, on the same theme, on Christmas Eve, just a shout out, we are doing again a service of peace at Bathurst and College Street with an imamah, Fareen Khan of Women's Mosque started it, and Cantor Wunsch from Shilabenu Synagogue, and we'll still sing Christmas carols, and we're going to be praying for peace. And so my hope for the new year is exactly that, is that we see peace break out in all of those places that that are fueling international hate. So that's my hope.
Okay, well, a Merry Christmas, and thanks so much for all your input, Janet Ecker, George Smitherman, Sherry DeNovo, and we will talk again in the new year, and Happy New Year as well. Thank you.
Same to you.
Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about food. We will talk about what the big food trends are expected to be in the new year, because just like everything else, it is affected by fashion and trends.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Pickle flavored everything and the high cost of beef. Those were among the big food stories of 2025. So what and how will we be eating in 2026? The prognosticators say beef will still be front and center, but with a focus on cooking fat. And this year, when it comes to healthy eating, it was all about protein, but apparently the focus is shifting to fiber. I'm not even entirely clear about what has protein, what has fiber, what has both. So I'd like to hear from you. Are you putting a different focus on, and are you going back to enjoy a buffet? Because that apparently is also coming back. Our text line is 866-740-4740. And now let's go to Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, head of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. Joyeux Noël. Hello. Merry Christmas. Hello. Thanks for joining us.
Joyeux Noël. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Thank you. So what do you think the defining trend for food going forward will be?
Actually, you covered quite a bit in your opening statement. I do believe so. Proteins have been front and center everywhere. I mean, you're buying coffee with protein now, Pop-Tarts with protein. So protein-fortified foods have been really mainstreamed in Canada and the U.S. over the last couple of years, essentially due to a few things. the price of beef, price of chicken, price of pork, all of these products are much more expensive. The GLP-1 phenomena, the Ozempic phenomena, is getting a lot of people to look for protein as well. There's over 2 million Canadians now that are taking an Ozempic type medication to lose weight only. And because in January we're going to see more generic drugs being available, we are expecting the number to increase even more. And so so that's why. But your point about fiber, I think, is bang on. I think people will, or even that's what I'm hearing in the industry, a lot of R&D is focused on putting more fiber into food. So we're going to see more fiber fortified foods over the next little while, not just in 2026, but over the next several years, I think, again, supported by the GLP-1 phenomena. And also people are looking for healthy foods and the clean labeling issue. So in other words, understanding what's in your food is there, and everyone knows what fiber means. And I suspect that more and more companies will focus more on adding fiber into the food.
Well, I looked at the list of what has fiber in it, and I think it's for people who are pretty focused on healthy eating. I mean, it's legumes, you know, beans, it's broccoli, carrots. Animal protein does not have fiber, so I'm thinking that unless it is fortified in some maybe packaged foods or convenient foods, you have to already be thinking about eating pretty healthy to get your fiber.
Absolutely. And but the other thing that we need to keep in mind is that when you're fortifying food with fiber, it doesn't cost a whole lot more to the food industry. I think there's some financial motivation there to actually make some changes that make sense to consumers without compromising food affordability. And prices are absolutely going to be a big driver in 2026 and on. Restaurants are going to be, I think, challenged by some of the things that are happening just because there's probably going to be fewer people looking to go out. And again, so people will be bringing more traffic to retail stores, grocers, and grocers will adapt to a marketplace looking for nutritious ingredients.
Back to this fiber and GLP-1. So one of the big stories of this past year was that food habits are changing because so many people are on these weight loss and diabetes drugs. Now, one of the advantages of fiber versus protein is that it regulates blood sugar. So is that an issue for people who are on these drugs? I'm not that aware of that.
I honestly don't. I'm not a medical professional. I'm not a health professional, so I can't really answer. I only look at how the GLP-1 phenomenon is impacting the food industry. And it is impacting the food industry. I mean, every time I visit a company, it comes up all the time. And so they're very careful with what they put in their food. And of course, January 1st, we'll have the front of package labeling. And right now, most companies aren't launching any food products if they have to put a label on their package saying that that product has either too much sodium, sugar, or fat.
And what about portion size? Because people who are on those drugs, they want smaller snacks. So is that changing as well instead of bigger snacks? Because we've been complaining about shrinkflation all year. So is now is that becoming a good thing?
There are fewer new shrinkflation cases around. But what I'm seeing are more skimpflation cases. Unfortunately, a lot of companies are changing ingredients. They're basically replacing an ingredient with a cheaper ingredient. They're putting actually water instead of fat or things like that. In fact, if you're a Kraft Singles buyer, you'll notice that your Kraft Singles are melting in your hands, and they're not as thick as they used to. So that's a mixture of shrinkflation and skimflation as well.
Oh,
and
goody.
So that's really what's happening there. So there now are more and more companies like doing that right now.
You mentioned fat, so I was surprised to read about and see videos of beef tallow, which is rendered beef fat, which apparently will be more widely used. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a trend, and people are looking for different ways to be creative in a cheap way. And so I think we're going to see more of these things happening in the food industry. The other thing that we're expecting to explode is the ready-to-eat counter at the grocery store. We actually think that there's going to be more and more people focused on eating in by buying some single serves at the grocery store much more so than before. So that's something that we're also expecting as well.
Okay, here I just got a text from Janice who says, I'm so old that I remember when Swiss Chalet cooked their fries in beef fat. Yes, so delicious. When was the last time you had a decent French fry? I don't know if she's asking me that or that's a rhetorical question. Yeah, tallow, beef fat.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think people are slowly going to go back to basics as much as possible. And that's really something that perhaps people will want to do is to remain authentic and natural. I mean, those are things that we're going to see more and more.
Uh-huh. So in terms of trendy cuisines, so I read that Indian is going to be more and more fashionable. I mean, when is it not fashionable? But that Indian food is on the ascendant.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what I'm hearing more and more is that we're not treating these cuisines as ethnic foods, quote unquote. I'm happy that people are kind of normalizing some of these new cuisines or cuisines that we have that we're inheriting and adopting from around the world. I think it's fantastic to see more variety. And I do recognize that the Indian that Indian cuisine in general is actually gaining in popularity. In fact, we're seeing more and more companies in the GTA and elsewhere producing Indian food for all Canadians, which is great. And so it's going so a lot of these cuisines are going mainstream, which is a good way to travel without a passport.
Well, a couple of things I noticed. So first of all, we're definitely moving beyond butter chicken. And even in grocery stores, right, you know, so they have so-called ethnic aisles. And there are more products. And as you say, they are more mainstream. And the other thing that I noticed here in Toronto is that there are a number of Indian restaurants that are, you know, Michelin-starred chefs. They're not what you would have expected with a small kind of joint in London when Indians first started moving to London many years ago. I mean, the takeout, it was you know, it was a cheap option, and London, of course, is full of a lot of great Indian food, but we're seeing a higher-end version as well.
No, absolutely, and I think the whole issue of mixing cuisines and selling products in a grocery store is a work in progress. A lot of grocers often will either create this quote-unquote ethnic section, which I'm not sure is a good thing. I do like when they mix things up. The only exception that I see is that sometimes when you have a grocery store next to, say, a university where you have a lot of international students that are here just for a couple of years, they do accommodate and they try to make sure that some sections are friendly to some students that are coming from abroad and, you know, they don't make sense out of a muffin or something like that or a bagel. So certainly, I think there's some sympathy there, by grocers that are close to campuses. But other than that, I'm seeing more and more grocers trying to mix things up a little bit, which is not a bad thing. It increases curiosity, and Canadians that aren't necessarily familiar with some cuisines tend to buy more of them because you're basically normalizing different cuisines from around the world.
Sylvain, I have to say that anything that helps me find a product from one time to the next is a good thing in my book, because and there's a certain category of products, and it can be in one of three aisles, and then if you find a person, they don't know what it is. The last time I was looking for bulgur wheat, try that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they didn't know what it was. And then it was on like this very bottom shelf. The labels weren't showing. And it was really, you had to crouch. But anyway, I got it. Final question. Another thing that I gather is coming back is buffets. I mean, since the pandemic, buffets are something that people tend to stay away from.
Yeah, I think it's that's the legacy of COVID. I think a lot of people have actually are second guessing buffets in general. I'm seeing the same thing, and frankly, because people are focusing more on health, some people are still attracted to buffets, but less and less. I think people enjoy having their portions size, and of course, this whole issue of sharing plates and things like that. Some people are very sensitive and have remained sensitive to that issue since COVID. And frankly, a lot of restaurateurs have actually noticed that.
So do you think it will come back, the buffet?
To a certain extent, but they won't be as popular as they used to. I'll be honest with you. And frankly, at hotels where they actually have breakfast buffets, they're not as popular as they used to as well. So you can feel that there's something going on here. But I don't think that buffets will disappear. They won't be as prominent as they used to, I think.
Okay. Well, on that note, we wrap things up. Sylvain Charlebois, Joyeux Noël, and have a very lovely, tasty Christmas.
Take care, Joyeux Noël. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we are taking a break. And yesterday, if you were listening, I was kind of bragging about my husband, who is about to turn 80 and is amazingly fit. But he is part of a very large cohort of people who are turning 80, the oldest baby boomers. And we'll talk about what that means when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, yesterday on the Zoomer Squad, I was boasting about my husband, Doug, and how incredibly fit he is as he is about to turn 80, and how he overprepared and aced the driving test you are required to take before hitting that milestone if you want to continue driving. Well, Doug is part of a huge cohort of the oldest boomers who will turn 80 in 2026. And that will have a big impact on how we live. So now I'm joined by Daryl Bricker, the CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs and the co-author of Breaking Point, The New Big Shifts Putting Canada at Risk. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So the first, the leading edge of the baby boom is going to turn 80 in 2026. And they're thinking that's what, around 400, 450,000 people here in Canada. So what will that mean for the rest of us?
Well, the baby boom generation continues to be the dominant generation in Canada. Even the millennials, by the way, we used to talk a lot about them. They're quite a bit older now, too. But for the foreseeable future, the baby boom is going to be the dominant group in the Canadian population. And by the year 2030, every single person who was a baby boomer is going to be 65 and will all be in sort of retirement age. So we've got that coming our way as well. So it's not just, it's interesting, you know, your husband's 80, but it's the people following him that are going to actually big the huge amount or huge number of people who are going to be coming in to that part of their lives.
Uh-huh. And what does it mean for our society that there are so many older people? I mean, one of the things that I don't like about this, I see a lot of attempts at fomenting intergenerational strife, saying that older people, and presumably the leading edge of people 80 and over, are just sort of taking up too much of our resources.
Well, in some ways, they're not wrong, though, Libby. I mean, the truth is that they are in the part of their lives in which they've accumulated all of the assets that one would have if the Canadian promise paid off for them. So they have the best houses. They're the ones with pensions. If anybody has pensions in this country, they probably got money in the bank. And they are also at the stage of their lives where they're going to be taking up more and more things like, for example, medical services. So I think, legitimacy for younger generations saying, hold on a second, you're expecting us to, you know, pay for all of this and that things will continue on as the way that they've continued on in the past. And I think that that's the source of some of this conflict, because for younger Canadians, it's not paying off the way that it paid off for their parents or especially their grandparents.
So let's talk about a percentage of the population. In the United States, by 2036, people over 65 will be like a quarter of the population. Here, by then, people over 80 in Canada, the projection is 3.3 million people. We're 40 million now. I don't know the exact number projected for 2036, but what will the impact of that be?
Well, it's interesting that you compare it to the United States, because the United States actually is younger than Canada. So if the Americans are getting excited about this, the Canadians should be even more excited. So the average or median age, so that's the age right in the middle for Americans, is about 39. In Canada, it's 42. And the percentage of people in the population, the number of people in the population 65 years of age or older, past the number of people 15 years of age or younger back in 2016. So we're actually aging faster than the United States is, combined with the fact that we have a lower birth rate than they do. Our birth rate's just over 1.2. Theirs is around 1.6. So the average age of Canada is going to accelerate more rapidly than it's going to accelerate in the United States. So if they're thinking about it now, we should be thinking about it even harder.
One of the things that people talk about a lot, especially when it comes to healthcare, is that part of the solution is through AI and technology.
Yeah, and AI and technology is going to play play a role here. So it's not just about the production part of what happens in the economy, or doing a lot of the things that look very interesting, but not very practical that we see associated with AI these days. Increasingly, I think we're going to be seeing it find its way into healthcare. And technology for the purposes of, for example, keeping older generations out of longer-term care facilities so we can keep an eye on them and take care of them in their own homes, which is, what, by the way, overwhelmingly their preferred solution, that's going to be something that we're going to be seeing more and more of. So if you're looking to invest in things today, I would say look at who's got the money. It's older people. And take a look at what they need. Invest in that.
Well, you know what? We here at Zoomer Media have been saying that for years, and it's amazing how, advertisers, marketers just refuse to accept that wisdom.
Well, I think the facts on the ground are going to change that. And honestly, Libby, I've been arguing the same thing for quite a while. That if you want to go where the money is, don't look at the kids, because there's not as many of them as you think, and they don't have any money. The people who actually are growing in the population, who have all of the resources, but we refuse to look at them as potential consumers and a potential market for us to sell our products and services to, are actually the older people. There's more of them and they've got more money available. So how can we convert them from being people who are just simply savers and kind of a nerd in the economy into active participation in the economy? That's where the money is going to be.
What about multi-generational things? I mean, we're seeing what multi-generational holidays that the older generation generally pays for. And I can only imagine how much it costs when you see, three generations having dinner at some resort over the holidays. It's an expensive proposition. There's an idea of multi-generational homes. How is that trend going to develop, in your opinion?
I think it's one of those things that is definitely a possibility. So when we tend to look at multi-generational homes, and I'll just use Canada, for example, we usually think of it as something that applies to certain ethnic groups, particularly more recent immigrants, where they, mom and dad come in, decide to live with maybe a son or a daughter who came over here as immigrants, and then they bring them over, and then their kids are also living in those places, which, by the way, is the way that families used to live. I mean, older populations used to take care of younger populations who were the kids of their kids. This was a fairly typical way of living. And then that group of the population took care of the older people. So it wasn't that they were invisible and they weren't present in people's lives like they are too often these days. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a return to that, because the requirement as a result of the expense of houses and also the ability to access the actual financial resources the families have, combined with the need to provide some of that light care that people are going to need in their older ages, I think all of it comes together in a way that makes a lot of sense.
And you think we'll see more and more of it?
Absolutely. I think what you're going to start seeing is, houses that are big single family houses. I think you're going to start seeing maybe a floor of that's going to be for, mom or dad, or maybe one, both of them, or maybe one or the other. And they're going to be providing a certain amount of assistance in the house. But by the same time, they're actually going to be provided with assistance by the people who are living in those homes. It makes sense, particularly in the older parts of town that tend to be the most expensive. Some of those bigger houses that you have in places like downtown Toronto, I think that there's a very good chance that they're going to become multi-generational.
Interesting. It's kind of a reversal of what's happened, I think, since the 50s. Now, what about politics? It's usually an older person's game. Is that going to change?
Well, it continues to be so, and we saw that in the last election, where the Liberal Party was overwhelmingly the choice of older Canadians, whereas the younger Canadians disproportionately were looking at the Conservative Party. More younger men than younger women. Younger women tend to flirt back and forth between the Liberals and the NDP, but younger men were looking at the Conservative Party. So, are we going to see this concern about younger Canadians not making the progress in their lives that they feel they should be making coming out in the types of political choices that they make? And the same thing for their grandparents and their parents. Are we going to see it expressed in the types of political choices that they make? I think we saw it in the last federal election in Canada. I wouldn't be surprised if we see it in the next one.
Okay. On that note, we are going to have to wrap things up. Daryl Bricker, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and we're going to see these trends that we've been talking about, come to fruition in just a few weeks. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, and the same to your family and all your listeners.
Thank you. Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. And I will be back here tomorrow, Christmas Eve, and we will talk and text then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.